Hey gang, this episode is brought to you by Means TV, the world's first anti-capitalist streaming service. Stick around after the episode to learn a bit more about Means and to snag a nice little discount as a thank you for supporting my channel. Right, I need to talk about two separate things. And at first, this is going to make sense. And then it won't for a second. And then it's going to start making sense again. Stick with me though, because I can't do this any other way. So we all know the US spends an insane amount on war. Bigger defense budget than the next 10 countries combined. Trillions to the DoD every year. And when you compare what we spend on wars to everything else, it's really bad. What not many people know, though, is that so much of this is waste. And not just like, war is bad, spend that money better waste. I mean literal waste. According to an official report, trillions of dollars of military equipment are just unaccounted for. As in, the Pentagon literally can't find it. We also overspend so much on weapons that the military will often outright reject new equipment because it doesn't know what to do with it. Great, that's thing number one. Here's thing number two. So, for a bit over half a century now, despite all their disagreements, the world's major countries have consistently agreed on something. And that's where to have their wars. Here, in the Middle East. Those of us living in Western Europe and North America, we've barely experienced anything that looks like conflict since World War II. But in that same time, there have been dozens of wars in or between countries in West Asia and North Africa. And there's obviously been a lot of that going on this past year. Israel's been on a genocidal campaign against Palestinians in Gaza, and they clearly want to move towards regional escalation by bombing Yemen, Syria, Iran, and Lebanon. Nothing new here. The US has been doing pretty much the same thing in this part of the world for decades. We invaded Iraq and Afghanistan in the 2000s and led many, many, many drone campaigns in Pakistan, Libya, Somalia, and most of the countries I've already mentioned. Great, that was the second thing. These two things may seem a little contradictory. On the one hand, you have weapons sitting there and being useless, and on the other, an incredibly excessive use of guns and bombs. But these two things aren't just related, they're mutually reinforcing pillars of a complicated system of international trade that slowly took shape in the second half of the 20th century. A shift in how control was split up between major powers, their vassal states, and a few key companies who, together, are constantly throwing us in the path of war and destruction, doing everything they can to push us towards waste, price gouging, and casually accepting the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people abroad. And understanding that relationship is the key to understanding both the motivations of the American Empire and the constant bloodshed in the Middle East. And the last piece of this puzzle is this little graph you can actually use to predict the next war. This is a graph showing two things, the price of oil and whether or not the biggest half dozen or so oil companies have a good ROI. And what's crazy about this graph is that when the line goes down, it takes a war to bring it back up. What this graph shows is that since around the 60s, almost every single war in the Middle East came after a moment of the Petrocor, the top fossil fuel companies, doing worse than the average Fortune 500 company. Before every conflict, fossil fuel companies were trailing behind. During every conflict, they start beating the average. And most importantly, they never manage to beat the odds without a war breaking out first. And I think you know why. Most of us understand that a lot of wars in the Middle East are about oil. We're usually told it's for other reasons, but we're not stupid.
Chemical weapons.
Terror attacks.
Cruel war against Kuwait.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Saddam Hussein.
Hamas.
Violent extremism.
The invasion of Iraq was supposedly brought on because Saddam Hussein had WMDs. Except he didn't. The invasion of Afghanistan was pitched as retaliation for 9/11 and for Afghan women's liberation. Also excuses that led to 20 years of objective military failure and worsening living conditions for millions. And the current genocide is, of course, explained away as the inevitable consequence of October 7th. We've heard that wars are caused by sectarian religious conflict, or that they're noble Western crusades against intolerable tyranny and spread democracy. Or if those don't work, we're often fed the racist myth that the Middle East is somehow backwards or full of people that are inherently more violent. Every excuse has been tried, And that's despite the fact that top U.S. officials have explicitly admitted that the oil interests are behind conflicts like Iraq. Frankly, it's not surprising. Bush Jr. and Dick Cheney were both white-collar oil guys, and Exxon, Chevron, BP, and Shell collectively spent more money on the 2000 election to get them into office than on any election before. No one was shocked when these two sailed into Iraq on the axis of evil rhetoric, and those same companies that got them elected won unprecedented access to Iraqi oil fields they'd been eyeing since at least the late 90s. But if Iraq was obvious, it's less clear what all these other wars have to do with it. That is, unless you understand a little bit about the price of oil. After World War II, America didn't want to be seen as just another colonial power. It didn't want to deal with the same headaches as the British because countries were gaining their independence and the Soviets made anti-colonialism globally popular right as the Cold War kicked off. At the same time, these countries that were gaining independence, specifically countries rich in oil, were taking their oil fields and refineries back from American, British, and French hands and started OPEC. An organization that would unite them, sporadically restrict the flow of oil, and make sure they'd get a healthy profit from a resource that, up until then, was mostly making Western companies money and leaving them with nothing. The problem was that while they had the infrastructure to extract and process the oil, they didn't necessarily have a good way to sell it. The logistics there required these massive Western oil companies. And politically, they also knew that kicking out Western powers completely was taking a risky gamble against countries known for responding aggressively to that sort of thing. So this is what happened instead. All the oil majors, those six or seven big companies, agreed to give up formal control over a lot of oil production. Since they were no longer in control of all the profits, though, they knew that if they were going to have this power taken away from them, it would have to be worth it. In exchange for giving up some of their power, oil majors expected to see higher returns than when they were fully in charge. And they got it. The next 30 years saw the net profit of these companies soar. And that's because everyone involved found new ways to play with price. It became in the interest of both oil-producing countries and these Western companies acting as middlemen, and the Western countries behind them, to set the price of oil as high as possible. Unlike what you hear in every Econ 101 class, the price of oil has very little to do with supply and demand, and a lot more to do with people's expectations. In any given year, the production and consumption of oil barely fluctuate, between 2 and 3% of each other. There's rarely too much oil, there's rarely too little. And so what you'd expect is for the price to stay relatively stable. But that's not what we see. Take the 60s. The supply started outpacing demand, and the reserves of oil were building up. So the prices did what Econ 101 would expect them to. They fell. But then the 70s came. Just like during the 60s, more oil was going into storage than was being used. Except this time, post-division of labor between the Petrocorp and OPEC, the price changed like crazy. Up 16% in 1971, 4% in 1972, 6% in 1973, and 228% in 1974. Same thing between 1975 and 1980. More barrels were being pumped out than could be absorbed, but unlike your Econ 101 predictions, the price kept going up. Then in the 80s, the story flipped. Suddenly there wasn't enough oil to meet consumption. But instead of that meaning high prices, like standard supply and demand theory would tell you should happen, the price crashed. That's because the price of oil depends not on what the actual amount of oil out there is. There's too much of it, pretty much always, either already pumped out or ready to be at a moment's notice. No, what decides the price at the end of the day is rarely ever actual scarcity. What matters is perceived future scarcity. And the thing that makes the expected future scarcity shoot up more than anything else is the fear of what might happen if a war broke out in the part of the world sitting on some of the largest reserves of oil. Energy conflicts, especially in this part of the world, always get confident sellers to charge higher prices and anxious buyers to foot the bill. It doesn't necessarily matter if the oil production or shipping is actually affected, mind you, just the possibility that it might be is almost always enough to pump up oil prices when the fighting is happening where at least in 1972, about two-thirds of the total world reserves were expected to be. So as the oil industry started to commercialize, and the ability to set prices got divided up first between OPEC and the large oil producers, and then even more between 150 new companies that started flooding the market in the 70s, all these different actors realized that having wars became the way that oil prices could increase and bring with them windfall profits for everyone involved, while at the same time protecting the US from looking like a colonial power and oil companies from coming across as monopolists. If no one could claim to have formal control over price and wars could seem inevitable, it wouldn't feel like war profiteering, just good luck at a bad time. And that is exactly what happened. The 1973 Israeli-Arab conflict, the 1979 revolution in Iran, the 1980 launch of the Iran-Iraq War, and the 90-91 Gulf War all brought oil prices up. And when those wars ended, they all came right back down. Thanks to wars, a perceived threat to oil supplies could secure tax exemptions, subsidies, and high prices for the core companies searching for regular above-average profits. But admittedly, all this is just one incentive. This doesn't explain why wars happen, necessarily. Just that when they do, it benefits a few people in the most lucrative fossil fuel jobs. So let's go back to those useless weapons. Around the 70s, as all this stuff with oil is happening, the US government started projecting that it would be spending less on its domestic weapons companies as the wars in Korea and Vietnam started winding down. They just didn't need to be spending that much, and protests sure made it seem like a huge waste of money. This really spooked weapons manufacturers. Thankfully, it just happened to coincide with everything we just covered. A lot of oil-producing countries suddenly finding themselves pretty flush with cash. Too much cash, actually. This was a problem for both the US and oil exporters. Without getting into too much detail, basically, the US worried about running into a balance of payments crisis, spending too much on oil and not exporting enough of its own stuff. And that fear was getting exacerbated by the fact that oil importers literally couldn't find anything more to buy. At a certain point, the influx of dollars they were getting from oil had nowhere to go when spending on both consumables, like food and clothing, and more durable things like cars and industrial machinery reached their limit. Oil exporters couldn't justify buying any more from the US. But oil prices kept rising and dollars kept coming in. Like the US, they needed to find a way to absorb that capital and recycle those dollars. This is where useless weapons came in. See, the good thing about guns is that you can never have enough. Unlike things like food, what makes weapons special is that the simple act of buying weapons is their primary use for their main consumers, governments. They don't even need to be fired for them to have completed their function. Saying you have more guns than the other guy is the point. And for countries trying to freak out their citizens and justify buying more, not having as many guns as the other guy is often justification enough. By claiming that they were always under threat and harping on national insecurity, Middle Eastern countries found a way to spend tremendous sums of money recycling the dollars they collected from oil back out on weapon systems that were getting increasingly technologically advanced and therefore expensive. Today, a fighter jet can run into the tens of millions of dollars per unit, so updating your fleet every few years with a new upgrade can easily become a sink for loose dollars. And the best part is, there's no limit. You'll literally never have enough because there's no expectation that you'll ever need to calculate how many you'll use. This, in turn, increases tensions, stokes fear of a possibly devastating conflict on the horizon, and increases oil prices, which justify increased dollar recycling through buying weapons. And you can actually see this in the data from this time. For all these oil exporters, every 1% increase in oil revenue meant a 3.3% increase in arms exports 3 years later. In other words, a key coalition emerged between weapons manufacturers, oil producers, and the leaders of oil-rich countries trading in dollars. But just because things are mutually beneficial for weapons manufacturers and oil producers doesn't mean they just happen. To make this official, the US government stepped in and instituted things like the Nixon Doctrine at precisely this time, shifting the burden of arming the US's allies, sometimes including countries on both sides of a war, onto those allies themselves. By the 90s, only 30% of the guns we exported were given as aid. 70% were now paid for directly by the buyer. And how does that happen? Just take a look at some of the weapons and oil people we've had in a few administrations. There has never been an administration that hasn't been staffed with major players from the defense or the oil industry. These guys lobby hard with both parties and always come out on top with a seat at the table. And they know that when they have that seat, they stay in tune with what their former and most likely future employers are thinking about. So long as weapons and fossil fuel companies are beating the average, these guys are happy just keeping the tension, letting the possibility of war and the anxiety around it drive up oil prices and building up arsenals a few years later. But as soon as their relative profits start to dip, the lobbying shifts to a more aggressive, hawkish stance, and the efforts to bring us back into a global conflict increase. But at the end of the day, war doesn't benefit everyone, and peace is often much better for things like tech companies who also have their own people in top government spots. It's not always obvious that we should be arming a war when other industries make more money. So when that's the case, weapon and oil industry plants have to actually do their job and use their position in the administration. Their lobbying skills, their leverage, and their power are all put to use trying to escalate anything, say a ceasefire or a no-fly zone violation, into kindling for an all-out brawl. This, in turn, plays up the insecurity rhetoric back home and justifies more domestic military spending, pulling national focus away from embarrassing questions like, why do we spend more than every other country on this when we could be funding universal healthcare? Don't forget, these are some of the biggest manufacturing companies we have in the US, and they use that power to do things like threaten Congress people with job cuts in their districts if they don't keep the war economy churning, even though all evidence points to the fact that investing in literally any other industry would generate more jobs than spending on defense, and as an added bonus, wouldn't murder people around the world. The grip of the petro-military-industrial complex is strong. So, just to recap, here's the situation we're in. Oil and weapon profits depend on a state of permanent tension and regular wars. Those interests have infiltrated the highest levels of government, frequently become our official policy, and have our government spending exorbitant amounts on defense contractors instead of anything useful while allowing oil companies to price gouge us. All of this benefits those who prefer war over peace. And notably, that includes longtime US allies like Zionists in Israel, who time and time again use the repeated incidents of war and the US military support to extend their control over more territory in Palestine, like we're seeing now in northern Gaza. The good news is that none of this is automatic. It takes actual people trying to influence policy to get their way for us to march down the warpath. The bad news is that that is the default option. With billions of dollars of lobbying to play with and a stranglehold on the reins of power, the era of useless weapons and expensive oil will continue. It will continue as long as the profit motive is allowed to dictate who lives and who dies. So until we can force change and shove off the jackboot of capitalism, we can never actually be at peace. As I mentioned at the beginning of the video, you can now find Second Thought on Means TV, the home for worker-owned entertainment. I've been working with the team to bring on a bunch more creators, so stay tuned for some exciting new additions to the roster. If you're not already familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos, to original series like Means Morning News, to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. As you all know, socialist creators have to walk a fine line here on YouTube. We're always having to contend with age restriction, demonetization, and outright suppression, which for some reason, right-wing outlets never have to deal with. But now with Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means TV gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and their fans right on the platform. And the best part is, Means TV is ideologically dedicated to supporting principled socialist content. As a little thank you for watching my channel, if you sign up with my link, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get 20% off the whole year. A full year of Means TV will run you just $88, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using my link is directly contributing to the financial stability of my channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Both Second Thought and Means TV are entirely grassroots funded, and they always will be. So if you'd like to help support my work, consider signing up for Means TV using my link. It really does help me and dozens of principled socialist creators all across the platform. If you enjoyed this video, consider dropping a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out my other content by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.